Live from welcome to New York. This is
the Just End the Suffering podcast.
For the win.
Got it!
Oh! He broke his ankle!
Follow me to freedom!
Y'all ready for this?
Here's your host, Mike Phillips.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the latest episode of the Just on the Suffering podcast. Your New York sports talk, long-suffering fan. Your host, Mike Phillips. I got another good show for you this week. We're going to continue our coverage of the NCAA tournament with Troy Moriel in just a minute. We're going to recap a very fun second weekend of the Sweet 16 Elite Eight. We have a Final Four all set. We're going to cover all that with Troy in just a bit. Also, look ahead to the podcast. This week's two-minute drill. And why the Knicks might be a bit stuck this year. We've seen some promise of them, but they might not have as much upside as we initially hoped. Talk about that at the end of the podcast. Like you hear the Just on the Suffering podcast, feel free to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon, all usual suspects. Simply search for Just End the Suffering, your favorite podcast platforms. You can follow episodes there. Feel free for your feedback and starring as well. Help with the podcast even better going forward. Check out the YouTube page, Mike Phillips on YouTube. The video version of the conversation with Troy is up on YouTube again. Mike Phillips on YouTube. Without any further ado, let's get to our opening tip. We're going to recap the opening weekend for the New York teams and New York baseball teams. And one did much, much better than the other one. That's coming up here right after this.
3, 2, 1.
Y'all ready for this?
The opening tip.
And here we go.
All right, opening tip time here, and we got a baseball season underway here. We have one series of the books. Could not have gone in more opposite direction if we try for the two locals. Yankees side, they make a big statement. Go to Houston, sweep the Astros for the four-game series. Considering how much of a problem the Astros have been for the Yankees over the past decade, this is a nice change of pace for the Bombers. This weekend really was the Juan Soto show. He was all over the place. Soto rakes the Astros pitching staff. He was 9-for-17, the double, a homer, four RBIs, including the clutch go-ahead hit against Josh Hader on Sunday. The Yankees also saw Soto make a tremendous play in the outfield earlier in the series. That was a tying run at home plate on opening day to help seal the team's biggest opening day comeback since 1950. And that's a long, long time. So good job by the Yankees there. Crazy that they swept this series in Houston. They didn't really get a lot of Aaron Judge out of Anthony Rizzo or Glaber. So it's a cool off eventually. He's brought some new energy and some swagger to the Bronx, which this franchise really desperately needed. He needed to change the vibes after the last couple of years. Soto does that. Makes you see how long the pitching's going to hold up without Gerrit Cole, but you figure the lineup's going to do his part. Great start in the Bronx. In Queens, on the other hand, things are a bit angsty. Mets looked every bit as questionable as they thought they would be when they got swept by the Brewers. Ironically, it was Milwaukee here for opening weekend. This is where David Stearns came from, the new president of baseball operations. He built the Brewers along with GM Matt Arnold. A couple other key front office executives there. In terms of the Brewers situation here, Stearns said he wanted to make the Mets more athletic, building on run prevention. His moves to the offseason were built that way. Brewers showcased the vision of what that was going to look like, and the Mets are very far from it right now. They still have a lot of work to do on that front. Milwaukee made a ton of great defensive plays. They stole 8 bases in the series. They used a dominant bullpen to stifle the Met lineup. Starting pitching was an issue throughout the weekend. Jose Quintana couldn't get out of the 5th. Luis Severino got through 5 and gave up 6 runs, which is not great. Tyler McGill lasted 4 innings before landing on the IL, the shoulder issue. Now, he did have some bad luck defensively. A couple of plays here or there were not made that could have been made. Pitching not being sharp, certainly not ideal. Also, the embarrassing way the Rhys Hoskins situation was handled. Irritated a lot of the Mets and their fans with a very late slide break with double play. A second on Friday, Jeff McNeil took offense to it. The benches cleared. Bullpens came out. No punts were thrown. Normally, situations like this, you figure, okay, next time he comes up, he gets brushed off the plate, and it's over. The Mets did not throw with the first inning of Saturday's game when they had the base open. They waited until the 8th inning for Johan Ramirez to throw behind him. By that point, Houston had torched them again. He homered, drove in 4 runs. Looked pretty lame, take a shot at him in the 8th inning. Do I get the idea of throwing Rhys Hoskins? Yes. Especially when the Buster Showalter Mets were 2 passing situations and got pushed around a little bit. Something like that can bond the team when done correctly, but as Ron Darling said, it should have been taken care of 2 hours earlier by Severino. Now again, not fair right off an entire season off a bad weekend for the Mets. They did have some good signs. Francisco Alvarez and Brett Beatty did flash some potential. We did have Starling Marte hit a lot of ropes, including a great home run to the driving wind on Friday at Citi Field for their opening day run and the only hit on the afternoon, their home run. You know that the foursome of Brandon Nimmo, Francisco Lindor, Pete Alonso, and Jeff McNeil, they're not going to stay cold forever. They really did nothing this weekend. Should have JD Martinez in the mix in the next 10 days as well, which should lengthen the lineup even further. The key is season, as we said last week with Anthony McCarron, as we said several times along the way here. Barring pitching, you need to get more out of it than what you got this weekend. He was already getting hit with injuries. We know Kai Senga's gone until mid-May. Tyler McGill is now on the IL. It means that one of Joey Lucchese or Jose Buto is coming up here in the rotation this weekend in Cincinnati. You can't get them out. You can't count the Mets out completely. Not yet. Still too early. They did show you a very realistic glimpse of how this season can go very poorly with what we saw against Milwaukee. And if we get more of that, it's going to be a very long year in Queens. We'll be seeing some of these prospects sooner than we thought. We'll keep an eye on the baseball teams going forward, but up next, we'll get into the March Madness with Troy Mariello right after this. All right, we are back here on the podcast. We are recapping the latest action from the NCAA tournament. We are down from 16 teams to 4. With me, as always, part of our March coverage. Well, now, technically, it's April 1st because the tournament started late this year. Troy Mariello is back with us. Troy, how are you?
I'm all right, Mike. Yeah, we, you know, as John Rothstein says, we sleep in May. We're now into April. It feels like we are a little late. We're like a week behind with everything. Feels like we should be recapping probably the Final Four this weekend, but week behind. But what a week of games, right? Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight got some awesome matchups, and we have a pretty cool Final Four. Maybe not the best Final Four possible, but four unique stories, so definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Here, and I say we talked about this last week. You said, hey, like not having Cinderella around, sort of like was going to lead to some better basketball games. For the most part, we got that.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we were just talking about, you know, yesterday you saw Purdue and Tennessee. You know, what a game between, you know, and a battle really between two of the, you know, better college players in the sport right now, and Dalton Connect and Zach Edey kind of going blow for blow. We did kind of end up getting that Cinderella in NC State, which is really cool. But, you know, we have that dominant force in UConn as well. And, you know, a really fun team in Alabama, at least a very entertaining team to watch in Alabama. We got some awesome games, you know, but yeah, so it's a pretty good Final Four as well. You kind of have a mix of everything. And the basketball this weekend, I thought was very, very high level. You know, even the Duke NC State game on Sunday, you know, that game was a plotting, you know, slow first half with a lot of missed shots, but NC State turns it on and scores about 55 points in the second half in that one and kind of goes crazy. And, you know, Saturday you see the dominance of UConn against Illinois with their 30-0 run, which I'm sure we'll get to. And like I said, Alabama, they play a very entertaining brand of basketball. You know, if you're an NBA fan who just kind of tunes into the NCAA tournament, the only time that you watch college basketball is in March, Alabama is probably your favorite team because they probably play the closest to, you know, the NBA type game of up and down the court. So, you know, a very, very entertaining basketball all weekend long.
Yeah, that's for sure here. And let's get to some headlines there. Not saying it was very quiet this week, though, for the most part, because Calvert State, he was in mass chaos in the coaching carousel. But a couple of names I want to throw out here to get your take on here on the coaching side here. So Chris Mack of Charleston, I missed this last week. Obviously, longtime Xavier coach. Now he resurfaces at Charleston. Good spot for that after Pat Kelsey left.
Yeah, definitely an interesting hire there. You know, Charleston is a program that has really done well in that conference for a while. And interesting to, you know, go with Chris Mack, a guy who has that, obviously, that, you know, high major experience. How can you dislike a hire like that? You know, a guy who has done it on the highest level possible in college basketball. So, you know, if you're going to replace a guy like Pat Kelsey, going with Chris Mack, can't hate on that one at all.
Yeah, speaking of Pat Kelsey, he's the one who got the Louisville job. He ended up taking that gig here. And considering how messed up the situation has been at Louisville, I mean, there were rumors they're talking to Richard Pitino, which would have been hilarious if they actually hired him after the whole situation with his father here. I think, like, yeah. They did about as well as they could have after they got spurned by Dusty May.
Exactly. I was going to say the same thing. You know, it was a really rough look, I feel like, for them for about a week with that coaching spurge. Obviously, like you said, with Dusty May. Going to Richard Pitino. Thankfully, they didn't go a step further and go to Rick. That would have been pretty funny as a St. John's fan. Not very funny as a St. John's fan, at least, seeing that one. But they do settle on a guy who I think is going to do a really, really good job there. You know, they need, this was probably the most crucial hire they've ever made as a program, with how, you know, Kenny Payne, how bad Kenny Payne has been there the past couple of years. They need someone that they can be pretty sure is going to turn it around. And I think they got their guy. The press conference, he looked pretty impressive. So, you know, we'll see if he can hit the ground running now, and turn around a program that, you know, I think we said this last week, they spend, you know, as much money on basketball as they do on football. Like, they are a basketball school. They're a basketball first school. So, you know, he's not going to have a lack of resources there. So we'll see about that. We'll see if he can turn it around right away in this era of the transfer portal, where you can go from a team that is the basement of your conference right into the NCAA tournament, in, you know, 11 months. So we'll see if he's able to accomplish that.
Yeah. And obviously Kenny Payne set the bar pretty low, so he has nowhere to go but up.
Yeah, exactly. It can't get any worse. You know, you finish middle of the pack in the ACC in year one, and it's probably a big success for Louisville. So that's the one thing he does have going for him. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and another one that sort of flew under the radar last week, I want to bring it up to you as a Big East guy here. DePaul, which has been the doormat since they showed up in the Big East 20 years ago, Chris Holtmann now is the head coach there after he gets fired by Ohio State. I think that's a solid pickup for them.
I love that hire, you know, and we just talked. I just talked about Louisville. What a crucial hire that was. DePaul's the same way, because DePaul is really teetering on the edge of like serious conversations of like, should this team still be a high major team? Can this team still compete on the Big East level? When you look at just how utterly uncompetitive they've been the past couple of years, you know, I'm a Big East guy, obviously being a St. John's guy. DePaul lost every game, and they really were hardly competitive in any of those games outside of the games they played against Georgetown. So this is a DePaul team that, you know, just needed to hit a home run with this hire. And I think they did that. You know, again, this is the era of the transfer portal. You have a guy who's done it on not only the high major level, but at a Big Ten program, who can show that he can do it on a high major program. Again, if you're DePaul, you're not looking to be, you know, in the NCAA tournament every year, in the top 25 every year type program. You're just looking to compete at this point. And if you can finish, you know, sixth or seventh in the Big East and play around 500 in the Big East, I think you're perfectly happy with that. You still have the Chicago area. You should theoretically have a large recruiting pool to recruit from, and as the transfer portal as well. You know, getting guys to want to play in that area, you know, and come back home maybe to play in the Chicago area. So I like the hire. Again, it's a tough situation that you've put yourself in the last couple of years, but I think you might have the guy to turn it around.
Yeah, a couple of quick ones in the West Coast bucket. I'm calling here. Andy Enfield leaving USC, go to SNU. That one sort of raised my eyebrow a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I actually forgot for a second that they were headed to the ACC, and I was like, that's a weird one. I guess when you realize that they're headed to a power conference, it makes a little more sense. But yeah, just a weird hire. Did not see that one coming at all. Again, a guy who's done it at the high major level. Now, you know, it feels like he goes now to the kind of the mid-major level, although, you know, SMU no longer a mid-major program, but I guess you like to see that, you know, a team that, you know, makes the jump up and is now investing in basketball, and you know, we'll see how it works out for them. Because I would say he's been a little bit of a disappointment at USC the last couple of years. Of course, this year, with all the talent that they had, not even really being competitive, you know, in the Pac-12, let alone, you know, being an NCAA tournament contender. So we'll see if he's able to have better fortunes at SMU.
That to me felt like an "I'm going to get out before they fire me" move from Andy Enfield.
Yeah, yeah, kind of like the move that you would expect Bobby Hurley to make at Arizona State, right? Like a guy who's probably, you know, on his way out, and you know, maybe I'll leave before I get the axe. You're absolutely right.
Another one in the West Coast department here. Kyle Smith takes Washington State to the NCAA tournament first time since 2008. Goes to Stanford, so he leaves the WCC bid to the ACC league, which I think is an interesting move on his part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another one where you go, wow, he left and he stayed in conference. He's pulling an Ed Cooley, and they realize, oh, Stanford's going to the ACC. Never mind. Again, though, you know, you would assume Stanford, you know, going to the ACC now. Stanford's been a program that really has not been relevant for a long time in the college basketball sphere. Going to the ACC, you would hope that they, you know, are going to make more of a commitment to basketball now, and that's a hire that you would think does just that. So, good hire. We'll see how it works out for them.
Last one here came up this week. Danny Sprinkle, 1 year at Utah State, wins the Mountain West regular season, goes to the tournament, wins the game. Now he's the head coach at Washington as they go to the Big Ten. I think it was a good job by them.
I think so as well. And you know, he's pulling the college basketball player, you know, taking a page out of their book, you know, spending 1 year at a school and then getting out of there and going somewhere else. But yeah, good hire. I mean, what a job he did at Utah State this year. Obviously, didn't end great for them, but they win an NCAA tournament game. and then get blown out by Purdue, but they win an NCAA tournament game, team with all those transfers, and he does a really good job pulling them together. So, I mean, you can't say anything bad about that hire right now because that was an awesome job he did in his 1 year at Utah State.
Yep, and now we get to the NCAA is an idiot department here with some of this stuff here. And this one, like, we don't usually talk about the women's tournament. There is a lot of fun basketball being played, but I just don't have the knowledge to talk about here. But I have to call out BS when I see it here. So let's take a look here at a photo for the YouTube people. I'm sure you've seen this going around. You follow sports like the old days. This is from the AP. It says, the NCAA says a three-point line was drawn 9 inches short at Portland Women's Regional by court supplier here. So to give you the background on this one here, the NCAA women's tournament is a little different than men's because obviously, like, that they do is they top 16 teams host the first round pods. They go into neutral sites. It's like if UConn's the top seed, they host four teams for a pod, so on and so forth. The regionals are two sites. One was in Albany, the other was in Portland. The court in Portland, as you can see by the photo, the three-point arc on the left is much shorter than the one on the right from the key. They were off by 9 inches. They played through two games on Thursday, two games on Friday. Somehow no one noticed this. Saturday, they noticed it. They measure it. That was off, and the two teams said, you know what, we'll play anyway because we don't want to hold the tournament up for them to fix it. So what a disaster.
Yeah, and first of all, how does no one notice that? Like, you look at that photo, it looks so obvious. I mean, I guess if you're not looking for it, maybe you don't realize it, but it's not like they were off by an inch. This is 9 inches. Like, this is, you know, like, how does no one figure this out? And they played all those games, like you mentioned, on the court. But yeah, just another move, you know, a clown move by the NCAA in what's been a rough month for them, especially on the women's side. I just, you know, the lack of attention to detail is absolutely disgusting. And like you mentioned, there's some awesome games being played on the women's side. You know, you have Caitlin Clark and LSU or going against LSU tonight, and just an awesome game. I mean, you know, this is probably the best that we've seen women's basketball in our lifetimes. And you have the NCAA making mistakes like this. It's a slap in the face to the women's game, in my opinion, to show that little lack of attention. Credit to the coaches, though, I guess, for you know, rolling with it and just saying we'll play through it. Because, you know, I know it would have been an hour delay, but I probably would have been like, no, fix that. Like, you guys messed it up. Fix it. I don't care if it takes an hour. You know, we'll go through our warmups again. You know, because obviously one team has the advantage in one half and the other one gets it in the other half. But credit to the coaches for that. But overall, just a really bad job by the NCAA, you know, to a sport that I think has really shown itself to be really fun this season and really caught a lot of new eyeballs this season. To do that, it's just an absolute shame.
Yeah, they've always been behind the eight ball in terms of the women's tournament, trying to, like, pay attention to the detail here. And we saw it back in the pandemic tournament, in the bubble tournament, when we saw the difference in the weight rooms between the men's tournament and the women's tournament. They tried to basically pass off just like a dumbbell, like a barbell, and some racks, like one rack, because, like, that's compared to, like, the mega full state of the art equipment thing. But yeah, that you had the whole situation this year where they forgot to check the back of a ref and assign the Charleston graduate Charleston game. They had to pull the ref at halftime. We have teams staying at a regional site in Utah who had to go to a different hotel because they're basically running into, like, racist threats to their players. The NCAA used to do a lot better for the women's side they've been doing.
Yeah, exactly. And these are all things, you know, this is a lack of attention to detail. And it's a shame because, you know, these are all easily catchable mistakes. You know, if you had people who you would assume it's their job to pay attention to these things and they're not doing it, you know, it makes all of my complaints about the selection committee kind of look silly on the men's side when you compare it to the women's side and what they're dealing with for their tournament. You know, it's really, really a shame. These games should be presented on level ground, you know, the men's game and the women's game, because that's how competitive the women's game has become. And to see the NCAA kind of throw it off to the side and miss things that are just so obvious and so easily fixable and easily catchable, it's a real shame.
Well, I'm good to detail is the right word, because, like, if this had happened, it's, let's say, at the UConn regional, if the court was off in Boston, like, we'll be screaming about it for days on end, but, like, it's kind of falling under the radar because it's a women's guide.
Exactly. Yeah. And it would be caught immediately. If I had to guess, someone is catching this like within, you know, in the pregame warmups of the first game and saying, hold on a second, we got an issue with the court here. You know, we got to fix this before the game even starts. To play a couple games on that and no one notices it. You know, I the players, I'm sure, maybe, you know, you just don't realize it. But how are there no NCAA officials there that say, hold on a second, something's off here. This doesn't look right. You know, how does it just, yeah, it's a real lack of attention to detail and it gives off the opinion, it gives off, you know, the viewpoint that you don't care about the women's game. And that's, you know, something that the NCAA has probably had to deal with for a while now. And you know, when, you know, actions speak louder than words. When you see something like this, that's what people are going to think, that you just don't really care as much about the women's game as you do about the men's game. And that's a shame, because like I said, the women are playing some awesome basketball this year.
For sure. Let's get to some of these regions here. We'll go through each region one at a time. We're starting the East, obviously. UConn dominates the statement of this region here, because obviously they blow San Diego State out of the water. Illinois wins a tight one against Iowa State here. This game was 23-23, the Illinois-UConn game, with 151 left in the first half. UConn goes on a 30-0 run over 50 minutes. This made it look like UVA playing in the first four here, what they did to Illinois. Like, this is absurd. And the fact that, like, UConn just, again, just so dominant is my big takeaway from the East region.
Yeah. No one's playing with UConn this year. It's their tournament to lose. I think UConn is the only team that can beat UConn this year. And by me, you know, they're the only team that could play. If they play poor enough, maybe someone can hang with them. The writing was on the wall for Illinois. You know, the couple of games, or the couple of days ahead of this, I think Brad Underwood on Thursday made the comment that he hadn't watched much of UConn this year and he didn't know much about them. And it was like, okay, that doesn't sound great. That could be a problem for you. And then I think one of the first media timeouts, they do the interview with him and he goes, you know, we're going to keep attacking Klingon. If he blocks 50 shots, he blocks 50 shots. And I was like, that doesn't sound like a good plan. I wonder what the Illinois game plan was, you know, saying that you haven't watched much of them, which first of all is just going to piss them off and make them play even harder, first of all. And second of all, how have you not watched much of UConn all season long? And then your game plan is just, we're going to keep attacking Klingon and let him block 50 shots. And that didn't work, as like you mentioned. I think they missed like 14 or 15 shots in a row in that 30-0 run for UConn. So the game plan for Illinois in that Elite Eight game just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but it didn't matter. I mean, no one's beating UConn anyways. At this point now, it's just, you know, can Alabama stay within, you know, 15 of them? And we'll see about if they end up playing Purdue. I think Purdue could hopefully give them a game, but I thought Illinois could give them a game and they just ran Illinois off the court. So, you know, at this point now, this tournament is UConn's to lose. They've won what now 10 straight tournament games, and none of them have really been even very close, to be honest with you. The last team that's played them close was my St. John's team. And even then they scored 95 points on us and they kind of had us at arm's length the entire way. So, I mean, they're just rolling teams right now. They're so deep. They have so many guys that can hit shots, so many guys that can beat you in different ways. I mean, you know, down low with Klingon and Samson Johnson, those two guys are two of the better big men in the country. And then, you know, Tristan Newton, Cam Spencer, Caravan, so many guys that can hit a three-pointer that can just kill you. And they didn't even shoot the three-pointer well, by the way, in this game against Illinois. They went 3-for-17 against Illinois. Like, can you imagine UConn, you know, if they were hitting their threes in this game, they would have won by 40 or 50 probably. Yeah. It's insane how they're playing right now. And like I said, it's a question of, can anyone hang with them? Because at this point, unless they beat themselves, I'm not sure who's beating UConn.
Yeah, for sure here. Yeah. And in terms of the Brad Underwood stuff, I did feel like this was very much, whenever I heard him like talk about UConn, it's all like the scene from Dodgeball with the whole bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if that pays off. Like, that's not basically that gif all over again.
Yeah, like I don't know if maybe he was trying to, with the comments on Thursday, you know, that he hadn't seen much of them. Is he trying to like motivate his guys? You know, they're just like us. You know, they're nothing special. Maybe to get his guys going. I don't know what his game plan was. Like I said, but it doesn't seem like there was much of a game plan for Illinois going into that game. And they were able to hang with them through most of the first half. But then, you know, UConn just comes out in the second half. I think scored the first 25 points of the second half as well. And that game was curtained. So, and I think Brad Underwood after the game was a little bit humbled in terms of his comments towards UConn, because he realized, you know, this is a team that's different. And, you know, they're now approaching, I think, the level of like, this is one of the better teams we've seen all time. So we'll see if they can close it out, you know, but if they are able to win these next two games, and if they win them in dominant fashion, you know, we're looking at one of the, well, that's the conversation for next week, but we could be looking at one of the better teams that the sport has seen in recent memory, at least.
Yeah, for sure. Let's go to the West region here. We got two interesting games on Thursday night. You had two upsets. Alabama outlasts UNC in a classic here. Clemson takes down Arizona. They don't get the Caleb Love revenge spot. They don't get to go to the Final Four at Phoenix. We got a instant game there where it felt like Clemson just punched them out their early outbound response and started blitzing them with three. So what do you think with the rest region?
Yeah, I do remember making a comment, you know, after on our show after the selection show, after the bracket was revealed, and I said this is going to be the region of chaos. I think there's going to be a lot of chaos in this region. Wasn't really correct with that, but at the end of the day, we do get what, a 6 seed and a 4 seed in our regional final, so a little bit of chaos. You know, this region was up there for the taking. I think I mentioned that, you know, in our show after the selection show. I did not love the 1, 2, or 3 seed in that region, you know, UNC, Arizona, or Baylor. And Alabama ends up taking it. Like I said, this is an Alabama team that can you know, go up and down the court. They play such an entertaining brand of basketball on Thursday against UNC. It was Grant Nelson who went crazy and really won that game for them. Saturday night against Clemson, they get such balanced scoring. They get 5 guys in double figures. Sears has been phenomenal for them, and he had 7 3-pointers in that game. Like you mentioned, though, I think Clemson had a great year, and I'm not taking anything away from Clemson, but they threw their punch, and then it kind of felt like they ran out of gas a little bit towards the end there. Great year for them. I like Alabama, though. They play a really entertaining brand of basketball. The question is, can they hang with UConn now? And I don't think so, because it just seems like even, you know, UConn against these offensively dominant teams is able to still score on them at will and then kind of, you know, hold their offense in check, like you saw what like they did against Illinois. I don't think UConn beats them by 30, but I do think that UConn really is able to get by them pretty easily. But obviously credit to Alabama. What an accomplishment for them making it to the Final Four out of that region. And like I said, you know, they had the opportunity of what I felt was a pretty weak 1, 2, and 3 seed, and they take advantage of it and they go all the way to the Final Four.
Yeah, I think one thing I noticed too about the Alabama game plan is obviously goes back to Nate Oates' roots as a high school math teacher here. It's like they take the NBA model to the extreme, basically, where I think like only like 2 guys are allowed to shoot mid-range shots, and the entire shot profile is either beyond the arc or at the rim, where they're going for either layups or fouls. So it's like they take a lot of the NBA teams are doing, just run it to basically perfection in college, which is something we have not seen before, really.
Yeah, I'm sure you saw that tweet about their shot chart for I think it was for the Clemson game, and it was literally all 3-pointers or at the rim. And I think there was one mid-range shot that was like a force at the end of the shot clock. But outside of that, it was all threes or everything at the rim. You know, credit to them, because that's the style that they play, and it's worked for them. And like I said at the top, you know, if you're an NBA fan, Alabama is a team for you, because they play probably the closest style to that NBA brand of basketball that we've seen. You know, and it's very entertaining. You know, I'm personally not a big NBA guy, but you know, when you put it in the college game, and it's such a stark difference to what a lot of other teams are doing, it's very, very fun to watch. And they've rode that all the way to the Final Four. So credit to them.
Yeah, let's go to the Midwest here. We got obviously some interesting games here. Tennessee, Creighton on Thursday night was fun. On Friday night was fun here. Purdue, I took a punch from Gonzaga, answered back, and ran away with the game here. Purdue, Tennessee. First, your thoughts on that game? That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, one of my favorite games of the tournament, man. I really enjoyed this game. Like I said, you had two of the best players in college basketball, Dalton Kennett and Zach Edey, and they just go blow for blow. Kennett scores 37 points, 6 threes. Edey goes for 40 and 16 and just goes crazy. Kennett was on fire early. Kind of, I feel like, trailed off a little bit. I just wish he would have gotten a little bit of help. I mean, Zakai Ziegler had a really rough game. And I don't think, no, Tennessee did not have one other guy in double figures besides Kennett. You know, he had 14 of their 24 field goals. So the rest of the team had 10 made shots, and he had 14. I just wish that they would have had someone else step up to really make this game fun, because, you know, it was a back and forth game. Tennessee felt like was, you know, kind of struggling to stay with them the entire way. And it kind of felt like all throughout that Purdue was going to win this game by like 5 or 6 points. And they do end up doing that. But awesome game from Dalton Kennett, and an awesome season from him as well in his 1 year at Tennessee. On the Purdue side, though, Zach Edey, man, was just unbelievable. Felt like he was just, you know, dominating the Tennessee bigs, getting them in foul trouble, getting them to the free throw line. I think he shot 22 free throws in this game. Probably one of the best games. I know he had a career high. One of the best games I've ever seen him play. Was just by far the best player on the court in terms of, you know, just getting the ball and either scoring or getting fouled. It felt like in the second half, the Purdue offense would just get the ball to Edey, and he's going to either score or get fouled, which, you know, has kind of been their offense all season, but it was like hyper on that towards the end of the game when they really needed some baskets. So you know, credit to Purdue. They finally get back to the Final Four. They finally kind of exercise those demons. And they do it, you know, not really being terribly challenged. Obviously, this game, they got a little bit of a challenge, but nothing crazy. And now, you know, they should have a real opportunity to play UConn in the national title game. So we'll see how that works. But in my opinion, like I said, one of the more fun games of the tournament when you had two of the best players in college basketball going blow for blow and really just going one-on-one almost. Really, really fun game.
Yeah, I think the other thing I want to touch on here with Purdue before we move on here is obviously Zach Edey thing. I feel like one of the big discourses online, especially on Twitter right now, is the whole idea of, like, is he getting a favorable whistle? Because obviously you mentioned that he went to the free throw line 22 times. We see a lot of people going, oh, Purdue, you're playing 8-on-5, you play Purdue. Zach Edey's not, like, never in foul trouble despite his size here. Like, do you think that he's having an issue, like, getting a favorable whistle here? Or do you feel like that, you know, like, I think it's, for me, it's 50-50. I feel like, yes, he draws a lot of contact inside. Yes, maybe you could call another foul or two on him on the other end, but I don't think it's been, like, outrageous, in my opinion.
No, and I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, he got to the free throw line so much in that game. It's so hard to officiate him, and they were talking about that on the broadcast because he's such a unique player with his size, obviously. You know, I wouldn't say that it was egregious, you know, the calls that he was getting. My only thing with Edey is sometimes he'll kind of get the ball, and it doesn't even really look like he's, like, trying to shoot it. He'll just kind of do the arm flail, kind of, and he'll get the foul call. That's my only thing with him, and he did it, like, one or two times against Tennessee, and that bothers me because it doesn't really look like he's actually trying to shoot the ball. He kind of just flailed his arms, and I think the official's like, oh, he had to get fouled, so we'll send him to the line. That's my only thing with him. But like I said, nothing like crazy egregious to where I'm like, that's not a foul. That's a horrible call. It's just, I think it's really, really hard for officials to deal with Zach Edey because he's going to get so much contact just naturally because he's such a big guy. So it's tough to officiate him for sure. I didn't think anything was out of the ordinary though in that game.
I think the thing that helps Edey a lot is if you watch him closely, like, he doesn't do a lot of these dumb, obvious fouls where he's, like, grabbing the guy and pulling him down on the hook and holds and stuff like that. He's not doing that a lot. He's got very good body control.
No. And, like, I mean, you know, to the people that are also that are, you know, taken away, like, I don't know how he's going to look on the next level, in the NBA level, but in terms of college, he's one of the better college players we've seen, you know, in a long time. And obviously a lot of that has to do with his height and his size, but, you know, I don't take anything away from Zach Edey. He's been an absolute, you know, crazy player the past couple of years for Purdue, and I'm glad that they finally get their shine and go to the Final Four now, because he's had an awesome college career, and you know, it's really been fun to watch him. I don't know how he's going to be on the next level. I know it's not my job to evaluate guys like that, but in terms of a college player, one of the better ones I've ever seen.
Yeah, let's go to the South region here as well. We got, obviously, the start with the big thing for me, Duke upsetting Houston here. Thing you feel about that game, because obviously Jamal Shedd going down really changed the whole game for Houston, because I think if he's healthy, I think they win that game.
I think so, too. Yeah, I just think that made Houston so offensively challenged in that game against Duke. And Duke, you know, up until the NC State game, had been playing some phenomenal defense throughout the NCAA tournament, and then they get torched really just in that second half against NC State. But Duke had been playing some phenomenal defense, but it just made them so one-dimensional. Houston, when Shedd got hurt in that game against Duke, and really turn the tables. I do think Houston probably gets by. At the very least, it's a very, very close game. You know, once he got hurt, it kind of turned into Duke's game to lose. But listen, they got a gift, and they took advantage of it. Credit to them. Obviously, then they get a big gift in playing the 11 seed NC State, and they can take advantage of that. But, you know, so it kind of ends up being a sour taste in their mouths with a chance, you know, to go to the Final Four and you lose to an 11 seed. But, yeah, I do think that game probably ends differently if he does not get hurt.
Yeah, obviously, let's talk NC State too here, obviously, where
yeah.
Now they go ahead, they beat Marquette in a game where, like, Marquette, like, missed more open shots than I've ever seen in my life. They had, like, in terms of shot quality, I think I saw they were, like, a 79 shot quality of 100, which means, like, if they hit, like, half of those, they're probably blowing out NC State, but they don't. That's the breaks of a one-game situation here. They beat Duke. Mm-hmm. They go on this big run at the end of this. They push them out of the water here. And now 9 wins in 19 days. They are now in the Final Four. This is a team that was losing in the first half of the ACC first round game to Louisville, the same Louisville who fired their coach after the season was over here. Now they're in the Final Four, and I think now we have to start asking, do we start taking the 2011 UConn comp series a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a crazy run for them. You talk about, you know, firing a coach. You know, they could have been having a serious conversation about their coach if that shot against Virginia does not go in, that half-court heave, which really saved, you know, their entire season. You know, if Virginia, first of all, makes a free throw up by three with 5 seconds left, that game's over. And you know, Virginia moves on to the ACC finals and NC State is out. And, you know, who knows about their coaching situations after, you know, kind of a mediocre letdown type season. They win that one. They beat it in North Carolina. And then they go on this crazy run in March Madness. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. You know, this is a team that really came from going, you know, absolutely nowhere in terms of this season. Who could have ever seen this coming? Even after winning the ACC and having that all that momentum, I don't know one person except for Jim Boeheim that picked NC State to go to the Final Four to even make like any semblance of a run here. Obviously, they got, you know, the huge gift in Oakland knocking off Kentucky and getting kind of an easier second round game. But then, I mean, you know, you got to credit to them. Listen, Marquette missed a bunch of shots. Duke, I thought, was completely lost offensively and just in that game against NC State. It felt like NC State kind of threw one punch in the second half and Duke just completely folded. Kyle Filipowski was horrible in that game and he fouled out. One of the worst games I've seen him play. Duke just had no answers for NC State in the second half, on either end, but especially on the offensive end. But like I said, I mean, you beat Marquette and Duke. Listen, they missed some open shots, but you know, you got to give credit to NC State for that run and beating two top 15 teams, in 3 days, really. To go to the Final Four, it's an incredible accomplishment for them. And it speaks to everything we love about March Madness. Obviously, the team that was kind of left for dead, the coach that had a lot of questions surrounding his future. One half-court shot goes in, and then all of a sudden, they go on this magical run down to the Sweet Six or to the Final Four. It's incredible. And it speaks to everything that we love about college basketball. To your point about, you know, the Marquette shooting in that game, I believe I was going back and looking earlier today. I believe the two best teams in this 9-game run that they've had that have shot the best from 3-point range against them, I think were Louisville and Oakland. Like, I think those are the two best teams. All the good competition, you know, North Carolina, Duke, Marquette, all the good teams that they played, the two best teams that shot the three against them, I believe, were Louisville and Oakland, which just shows you the absurdity of March. Like, how does that happen? But DJ Burns has become, you know, America's, you know, darling now. And he rolls onto the Final Four for a really cool matchup against Zach Edey. So we'll see that. But just the best part of March is NC State.
Yeah, so the only guy who could beat the NC State three-point defense is Jack Elke.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, how crazy is that? Like, all these high-powered offenses, all these top 15 teams that you're playing, and Oakland is kind of the one team that like, kind of figures you out. And you get, I mean, Oakland was the team in the tournament that's given them the best game so far. Yeah. Like, that game went to overtime. That was a great game. They rolled through Texas Tech. They really were in control the entire game against Marquette. And the second half, they dominate Duke. Like, of their NCAA tournament wins, Oakland was the one that was the most in question, which is, again, just crazy, the absurdity of March. Now they run into a team in Purdue, which, listen, if they beat Purdue, I might just have to pick them against UConn if it is UConn in the final. Like, they might just be a team of destiny at this point if they somehow get past Purdue.
Yeah, I will also say here, before we move on to the Final Four preview here, in terms of Duke here, this has to be massively disappointing. You brought up last week, they hadn't won as the lower seed in the NCAA tournament for like 30 years. They do it. They get an NC State team in here that was basically like a team they had beaten the regular season. Yes, they lost in the ACC tournament, but like they have a letdown in the second half here. I don't think any player on that roster went backwards more year-to-year than Kyle Filipowski. I remember last year, Filipowski saying, oh, like this guy should be a lottery pick if he comes out, he stays. Mm-hmm. And like he was invisible the entire NCAA tournament.
Exactly, yeah, and I mentioned that before. He had 11-9, 3 of 12 from the field, 0 from 3 from 3, and he fouled out with a couple of minutes to go. And on the other end, he just let DJ Burns absolutely dominate him, going 13 of 19 from the floor. Filipowski was horrendous in this game. And like I said, Duke just, you know, outscored by 18 in the second half, up 6 at halftime, you know, to really not even being close in the second half. It just felt like NC State kind of, you know, made that punch, like I said, threw that punch, and there's no one on Duke to respond. You know, Filipowski, who you would have assumed was kind of your leader, you know, your guy who's your go-to guy, was not there, and Duke was just so disjointed offensively, and they had a, you know, sequence there where they could not get a stop defensively either on both ends, but especially on the offensive end, just a really, really disjointed performance by Duke. And what a missed opportunity, because, you know, like you said, they finally beat a team that's a higher seed, and then they get the gift of Shed going down and, you know, beating Houston. And now with a trip to the Final Four on the line, you play an NC State team that just beat you a couple of weeks ago. That's an 11 seed that, you know, from a talent perspective, you know that you're better than them. You know, at this point in the season, NC State's probably playing a little bit better than Duke. But from a talent perspective, you know that you're better than them. You're holding teams to like low 50s in the NCAA tournament, and you give up 55 points to them in the second half. I mean, how many Duke fans were probably buying their Final Four tickets at halftime, up by six in this game, saying, you know, all right, well, you know, we're going to close this out. We're not going to blow this lead. And you get 55 in the second half. Just an absolute bummer for them, you know, with a real opportunity to make a run to the Final Four, which would have been an unexpected run because no one was picking this team, or not no one, but very few were picking this team to go to the Final Four. And they got the gift, really, of playing an injured Houston team and then an 11 seed NC State in their you know, Sweet 16, Elite Eight rounds, and they're unable to get it done. It's got to be a disappointment for them.
Yeah, sure. Let's get to the Final Four now. We'll look at these two games here. First up here, the we'll start with the early game, NC State and Purdue, which, I mean, NCAA, I'm sure, was not happy. I had to put UConn in the late games. UConn's been crushing people, but yeah, that's the way the matchups broke here. I think this game has a chance to be a lot of fun here because NC State's playing with house money, and Purdue mm-hmm. has all the pressure. Oh, you have to beat the 11 seed to get to the shot at UConn here. And I think, unlike pretty much any team they play a tournament this far, NC State has a guy who can give Edie a different look in terms of like a very physical banging body down low with DJ Burns. I think that's the match of the game.
Yeah, yeah. And if Burns can stay out of foul trouble, that's the one thing, you know, guarding Edie, as we've seen, obviously, we just talked about it. You know, it's so hard for them to officiate him. And, you know, he had the way that he's able to draw fouls. If Burns can stay out of foul trouble, that is the matchup that you want to watch. You know, one of the most unique players in college basketball, and DJ Burns, and then one of the best in Zach Edie. What a matchup. But this kind of gives me vibes of, like, you know, Purdue playing a 16 seed again. Not that NC State is a 16 seed, but, you know, Purdue is such a big favorite in this game. Everyone assumes that Purdue is going to roll through this game. You know, what happens if NC State is up five with 7 minutes to go? You know, what happens if this is a 2-point game at halftime? Like, does Purdue start to get in their own heads? Because, you know, I feel like the talent discrepancy, was not all that different between Purdue and Tennessee. That was a good game for them, but, you know, in terms of playing an NC State team, it's like you're so heavily favored. Everyone expects you to roll through this team. What if it's a close game? What do you do? You know, do those memories of losing to a 16 seed last year and losing to all these double digit seeds, do they creep in and do they start to mess with the heads of this Purdue team? That's what I'm curious to see. You know, is this a close game? You know, can NC State hang with them? And then does Purdue start to get in their own head like we've seen them do in previous NCAA tournaments? And does NC State somehow, you know, continue this Cinderella run all the way to the final?
Yeah, I think another thing to watch if you're Purdue, I know it's easy to drive their entire offense here, but I think, like, they have so many guys who can shoot the three ball. They have, like, six guys in rotation who can shoot over 42% from the floor, from the three-point line. They got to knock down their outside shots against the NC State team that will give them up if you are opportunistic there.
Exactly, yeah, and it's like we've been saying, you know, NC State, you know, teams have not shot the three well at all against them, but I don't think it's really been due to their defense. I just think it's been teams missing open shots, you know, and Marquette was a really good 3-point shooting team as well. And they couldn't hit an open shot. Duke, you know, same thing. So, you know, Purdue's going to get good looks. You know that you're going to get good looks, especially, you know, with the way that you run your offense through Edie and then kicking it back out. You know, can these guys on the outside hit some 3-pointers, you know, Braden Smith, Fletcher Lawyer, can these guys hit threes that are going to be good looks? You know, can they step up? And can they give you know, what they've been giving you all season, basically continue that? And if they are able to do that, I think that NC State or Purdue should roll through this game. But we'll see, you know, if that trend continues, if teams just missing good looks against NC State.
Yeah, we'll go to the other game now, the UConn game here. And early line, UConn's favored by 11.5, which feels very, very high for a Final Four line with a 4 seed in the mix here. The thing I would worry about this game here is that obviously Alabama can score anybody here, but their defense, again, is a problem because they're not going to – they really have nobody inside to slow down Donovan Clingan, which is a big issue because he will just go to the rack. I think he's going to go for 30 points plus in this game here. And on the defensive end, too, having Clingan down there is somebody who can impact those layups here. It makes it very easier. UConn say, hey, let's just chase you off the three-point line and drive you into the middle of our defense.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I just – I don't know how Alabama stays with them. You know, you talked about that spread – you know, it just feels like Vegas is like, how high can we reasonably make this thing to start to at least get some action on Alabama? But I just think, you know, everyone's going to be on UConn, obviously. And then I don't know how Alabama stays within 15 points of UConn. Nothing against them. But like you mentioned, man, I don't know who's guarding Zach Edey or who's guarding Donovan Clingan. I don't know who's going after Clingan on the offensive end. UConn is just such a wagon right now. I'm not sure how anyone stays with them. you know, for the course of a full 40 minutes. The question is, you know, is this game a game at halftime? Because we've seen UConn basically through the first three games, or the first four games of the NCAA tournament, you know, their games have been over by about, you know, the 15-minute mark of the second half. So is this even a game, you know, late in the second half, midway through the second half, early in the second half? Is Alabama able to hang with them? Nothing against them. It's just UConn's on a different level right now. And, you know, we just saw them play a really talented offensive team in Illinois, and you saw what they did against them, you know, holding them scoreless for almost an hour of real time. So they got a week to game plan now for Alabama. Don't love Alabama's chances. Nothing against them. It's just how good UConn's been all season long.
Yeah, for sure. And obviously, our last question here, I want to touch on you on this here. Like, UConn's just always been so dominant. They've won every game of the tournament by 23-plus points, which is an absurd stat to think about here. Yep. Like, they they beat you in so many different ways here. Like, is there a way for somebody in this Final Four to actually beat UConn, besides UConn just not showing up for a game or playing very sloppy?
I don't think so, man. Like, I don't know. I don't – because even a bad, you know, a B-plus game for UConn, I still think that they win. Like, they're just so – they're so deep. They have so many guys. You know, if Cam Spencer's having an off game, Alex Caravan's gonna pick it up. If Tristan Newton's having an off game, Diarra will come off the bench and pick it up. Like, they're so deep. They have so many guys that can beat you. You know, to have six or seven guys at the same time have an off night, it just doesn't, you know, they're too good. Like, it's just not gonna happen. So unless they make those mental mistakes, you know, and kind of beat themselves, which they're not gonna do because they're so well coached with Danny Hurley, they're not really going to make those mental mistakes. They haven't done it all season long, and really even last season they didn't do that. So it's just I don't see a path to beat this team. Like I said, they're too deep. They're too well coached. They can do it inside. They can do it outside. They can do it on the offensive end. They can do it on the defensive end. You know, I would love to see them play Purdue, because I do think Purdue can at least challenge them. You know, with Edie going against Klingon, Edie is probably has the edge there, I would say, over Klingon. But that's an awesome matchup as well. So I want to see Purdue against UConn. I think that would be at least a somewhat compelling matchup. Because other than that, I don't know if either of these other two teams, Alabama or NC State, can even really challenge them. They're just on a different level this season.
Yeah, I think for me, the key to beating them is getting Klingon off the floor in foul trouble, because we've seen the stats that, like, I think they're like, they were like, I saw, I think what game, I think it's the Illinois game they're putting up here. I think that UConn was like plus 27 with Klingon on the floor and minus 7 when he's off the floor, because he impacts the game in so many ways on both ends. I think if you can get him out and you don't have that big monster in the middle blocking shots and altering the defensive end of this year, I think that's your chance. You have to get him in foul trouble. I think other than that, they have to beat themselves.
Yeah, and that Klingon, I mean, I think we saw the same stat. I want to say they gave up, like, it was an absurd number. It was like 14 points or something like that with Klingon on the floor against Illinois. They're just a completely different defensive team as well, with him on the floor. And like you said, you know, in a game like a team like Alabama that doesn't really have anyone that can match up with him, you know, you wonder if they're going to be able to get him into foul trouble and get him off the floor. But yeah, if there is a path, that's probably it. You know, maybe getting Klingon off the floor and seeing what you can, if you can attack defensively then. But yeah, I don't see anyone competing with them this year.
I don't either. We'll be back next week to break it all down. Troy, thanks for all the time. Really appreciate it. If you want to follow you on social media, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, at Troy Moriello. It's M-A-U-R-I-E-L-L-O. Definitely check me out. Like I said, if you're a St. John's fan, you know, I'm tweeting about St. John's all the time. You know, transfer portal, Rick Pitino, getting to work on that. So definitely check me out.
All right, Troy, thanks for all the time. Really appreciate it.
Definitely, Mike.
The 2-Minute Drill.
All right, 2-minute drill time. Let's shift to the Knicks for a minute in the NBA. They're on the way to the playoffs. They suffered a pair of discouraging losses over the weekend. They fall on Friday in overtime to San Antonio, despite 61 points out of Jalen Brunson, a career high. That's a bad one. I guess one of the worst teams in the league. That was on the road. They come home Sunday night, blow a 10-point fourth quarter lead at home, and lose to the Thunder 113-112. To be fair, the Knicks, they are still playing extremely shorthanded. Several key starters are working their way back from injury. OG Anunoby came back for a week with the elbow injury before he aggravated it. He's going through what they call elbow injury management. It's not clear for contact. Julius Randle still trying to come back from a dislocated shoulder suffered at the end of January. Not clear for contact, trying to build up his endurance, but he's not cleared yet. Mitchell Robinson actually came back this week from ankle surgery. Played in two games, re-injured the ankle the second games. Who knows how long he's out. And standings-wise, Knicks are still in a good position. They're a half game back of third place behind Cleveland. They have a game in hand. If they get into that top three, they would avoid Boston until the Eastern Conference Finals, which is ideal here. But they are running out of time to get their guys back, which is a problem. They have 8 games over the 2 weeks left in the regular season. Not a lot of time to get guys on the court into the flow of NBA basketball. Avoiding the playing would conceivably buy you more time for these guys to get back. But even so, you're probably not getting any of them at 100%. We saw last year in the playoffs that Julius Randle at 75% is not the same Julius Randle as all-NBA level. This current roster might be the best the Knicks get. Josh Hart said much on Sunday. He said that the injured guys do not exist until they're actually ready to go, and that's the right attitude to have. You can't look at this and say, oh, OG's going to save us. Julius is going to save us. Until they're there, you have to look at who you have and roll who you got. The good news is this team still plays hard. They still play great defense. But it's upside severely capped without those guys, especially when Jalen Brunson has to sit for a breather. I believe they average about 123.7 points per game when Brunson's on the floor, dropped, which is the best in the NBA or up in the top three. They are 103.7 points per game offensive efficiency when Jalen Brunson sits. That's a problem. And it's a shame, too, with this injury thing with the Knicks, because we saw how ridiculously high their ceiling was when everyone was healthy in January, that 14-2 run, saw them beat multiple top contenders. Perhaps next season things will get to the point where everybody's healthy and they're clicking and they're playing well, but don't be surprised if the Knicks exit the postseason earlier than we'd hoped. And with that, I want to end the show for the week. I want to thank my guest, Troy Moriello, for coming on once again to recap the latest action in the NCAA tournament. We got another weekend here of basketball with the Final Four on Saturday, the championship on Monday. We'll get off on that. Why we're going to stuff like this pie is clearly look at all the options the Jets have with the 10th pick in the draft. Check out the blog over at justendthesuffering.wordpress.com. Check out the Sky Guys podcast. We recap episode 9 of The Bad Batch with special guest Max Roberts. That podcast is in the feed right now. Another double episode coming this week. Episodes 10 and 11 The Bad Batch Season 3 are coming on Wednesday, so that podcast will drop Wednesday night. You want the Sky Guys content, Star Wars content, same podcast platforms at the top of the show. Subscribe to those. So follow me on social media, mphillips331. That's M-P-H-I-L-I-P-S 331. That's going to do it here for this week's podcast. Coming up next, we'll be back on Sunday. We have a Masters preview coming. I'll recap the Final Four and preview the National Championship game and more. So we'll have a better week than Houston fans.